Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The rebel buns is grooving them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther Teague.
Hey, Souther. How you doing, buddy?
I'm super well. Happy to be here.
Excellent.
It's a day in Brooklyn.
It is. It is a day in Brooklyn. I was just commenting on your shirt.
Oh, yeah.
You were just recently in Cleveland. You're wearing this Porco Lounge and Tiki Room shirt.
I love it, man.
This place great design.
Place is great. Tiki Bar in Cleveland, Ohio. That's right where Tiki Bars come from, right? Well, that's where the Contiki was, don't forget.
Yeah,
In fact, these guys went and salvaged a lot of the decor from there. Like, they got this giant sailboat up inside the ceiling. They've got the actual front doors of the Contiki are on the front of this place.
Like, it's Adam Kolesar, better known as Tiki Adam. He's from Ohio, and he's told me a lot about Contiki, and so it just makes sense. It's I think there's some strong reasoning behind the reason why they were Tiki bars in Ohio. That escapism.
Exactly. You know? Total landlocked. Well, I mean, they're not totally landlocked. They're near the lakes and whatever, but they're not in any, like, Polynesian waters, that's for sure.
That's true.
But, man, this place, Porco, they're killing it. A guy named Stefan Waz owns the place.
It's cool, man.
It's amazing.
Well, next time I'm in Cleveland, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I know you're frequently in Cleveland.
I need to go. I need to go.
I'll go. I'm going back. So you go with me.
Let's tape a show there.
Deal.
All right, cool.
All right, what are we going to do on this show today?
We're going to talk with Henry Jeffries. He just released a book called Empire of Booze, and it's a history of the British Empire told through drink. Welcome to the show, Henry.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Welcome here. Let's jump into it, man. Let's talk about your book.
Empire of Booze.
Empire of Booze. Well, the title is the best thing about it.
Is this where the Empire Strikes Back? No, that's the next book. but which is a prequel. So Empire of Booze.
Technically, it's a prequel.
It's kind of taking us through a history of the British Empire and how it...
Well, it was meant to be a kind of history of Britain told through drink, but it actually turned out to be a kind of history of drink told through Britain. What really interested me were the drinks. So it's about how Britain, by basically meddling around the world and becoming rich and powerful, inadvertently created drinks like port, rum, whiskey, India Pale Ale, that sort of thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that comes to mind for me is rum.
Yeah.
You know,
I always think of the British Empire as the gin tonic. Because I have jokingly said, like, without the addition of tonic, which was, you know, malaria.
Quinine. You know,
yeah. Would push away malaria. Without the addition of the tonic to the gin, then the map of the world would look very different.
Well, they'd all be dead, wouldn't they?
Yeah, right.
I mean, they are dead already, but they would have died sooner.
Yeah.
And not
before they finished whatever they were doing.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I thought it was a very kind of British attitude to a problem. You've got this tonic that tastes revolting. Let's stick some gin in it. You know, make it taste better.
Yeah, a spoonful of gin makes the medicine go down.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that way about the old fashioned. I feel like it's like you got bitters, which is your medicine. They're bitter. You water it down to make it more palatable. Maybe put some sweetener in there to, you know, balance it out. It's like, then the old school mentality was just, hey, let's just throw some booze in there too. And then all of a sudden you got the old fashioned.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's an interesting thought. So there, the map of the world would look a lot different without tonic.
Well, I used to give a gin class all the time, you know, when we had Gin Palace, and I would have to talk about the styles of gin and where they came from and how they got there. And then when, of course, I got to London Dry Gin, I would say, well, then these guys were down exploring Africa, a lot of mosquitoes. I mean, is something like this in your... I haven't read the book yet.
Yeah, there's lots. There's lots about sort of mosquitoes. And
so these guys are out discovering and exploring, and they realize that they've got this malaria tonic on their hands, and they've also got plenty of gin on their hands at that time.
Yeah, they didn't have any ice, though, so, you know, it must have been... They were just there going, this drink just needs something. It doesn't make any noise when you go like that.
Yeah.
And then someone, I think it was probably an American, because Americans have been very into ice for a long time.
Yeah.
And so probably an American just was like, why don't we put some ice in it? And then it was like, amazing.
Yeah.
And then likely, you know, along came effervescence. Oh, that even lightened it up more.
Yeah.
But when British people went to America in the 19th century, they used to just be amazed by the amount of ice that was around. People would just, because the Americans would put ice in anything. The British were like, what the hell are they doing? They're putting ice in their beer. They're putting ice in, you know, in their tonic water.
Yeah, well,
we're super chill over here.
if you go to a British restaurant and ask for a glass of water, they still won't put ice in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Which I kind of actually prefer. I don't put ice in the drink, in the water at a more either. But that's I have a whole different reason for that. It's all about metabolism. You metabolize water that's room temperature faster than you do water that's chilled.
That's a top fact.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... you know, hydration is important while you're drinking. So if you're drinking ice water while you're drinking, you're not keeping up with that hydration level that you need. That the old adage, one drink to one water.
Right.
If it's ice water, you're not really getting the benefit.
Maybe that's why I've got a hangover, because I was drinking ice water.
Yeah, hangover this
yeah,
afternoon.
Blame the ice. The piano has been drinking at me.
Yeah.
Cool.
So how did you set out to write this book? Did someone come to you and say, you wrote a book about breakfast, now write this?
Well, it was a very long drawn out. I had the idea when I used to work for a wine merchant, and I kind of had the idea because I saw all these bottles of Taylor's Port and Harvey's Bristol Cream and things like that. So I thought there's a kind of story about Britain, and I kind of played with it for a long time. And I went to lots of publishers with my agent. I got a literary agent, and he got in touch with me. He was the person who worked on the breakfast book.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you must have an idea for a book. So I told him about Empire of Booze. And he said, great idea. So we took it to a few publishers, and they weren't very interested. And then he kind of lost interest in it as well. But then he was a former alcoholic, so a book about booze probably wasn't the best book for him to be doing.
I don't know. Make some money off your demon.
Yeah. Well, he specialized in books by washed up rock stars that he met through Alcoholics Anonymous. So that was his kind of shtick. And a sort of book about booze he wasn't very interested in. So anyway, then I went to a publisher that crowdsourced the first print run. And that's how it happened. So it was a kind of modern publishing story.
And how did you go about doing the research for this thing?
Just, you know, sitting in bars, drinking, thinking, doing a bit of reading. And then I went to Porto and round distilleries and been a beef eater in London and a few in Scotland and that kind of stuff. Went to Jerez. So I sort of did a lot of traveling.
Wow.
All
the trade routes. All the trade routes. You just went and sort of sought them out on your own and saw how things were moving.
Yeah, yeah. I just sort of did the kind of journey that a lot of British people had done before me, though I did it, you know, in a more comfortable surroundings. I flew rather than going on a wooden ship.
A wooden ship that took you know, half years. A year or whatever. Yeah. We've modernized travel considerably since then.
I've often wondered what the, because I've never been to India, but I've often wondered what the drinking culture is there compared to the old British days.
Well, I think they still drink a lot of whiskey. I think whiskey is the sort of main drink.
And it's like three pipers, right?
Yeah,
like,
three pipers. Or if you go to a wedding in India, I've never been to a wedding in India. Apparently, a posh one, they'll have Johnny Walker Black Label bottle on each table, and that's what they drink. So they have a sort of slightly, I suppose, quite an old fashioned drinking culture. You know, people don't really drink wine. I don't think many people drink beer. I think when you drink, you drink.
Yeah,
and then the rest of the time you don't drink.
whatever time is left over. Yeah, I don't know. Oh, sleep.
Sleep?
Yeah, when you're sleeping. Yeah,
sleep when you're dead.
I pray for that day. Cool.
So like. From the pages I've read so far in the book, it's great cover, like great artwork. My friend Mariah lent me the book to start reading, and it's my favorite kind of reading because it reminds me. There's a book I can't remember. I think it's Ian Gailey, maybe. There's a book called Alcoholica Esoterica. It's out in Penguin Publishing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That book's great.
It's just like anecdotal, like, history of drinking. And your book is kind of that, but just specifically, like, on the British side. So there's some really cool stuff about... let's talk about something that's always fascinating to me. Champagne. Let's talk about that for a second.
Well, the champagne one is a sort of controversial one, because a lot of people have claimed that the British actually invented champagne, right, which is kind of bollocks because they didn't really. But what they did invent was strong glass, so that when you try and ferment something in a bottle, it would have just exploded. But this man called Sir Kenelm Digby invented a process for firing glass, making a very strong, dark glass that's still known in France as verre anglais. And then there were scientists at the Royal Society, which was a sort of organisation, like Isaac Newton was a member, so they were discovering gravity and elasticity and things like that. But they were also experimenting with bottle-fermented cider. So there were people reading papers saying, you know, I put some sugar in and I put some yeast in and I put the cork in, and then it exploded, and then I got a stronger glass, and eventually they made sort of very rudimentary sparkling wines and ciders. But what they didn't do was kind of industrialize the process, which they did in champagne. In champagne, they actually perfected it and made it reliable, whereas this was just a few kind of
crackpots,
basically, yeah.
Derelicts with time on their hands.
Yeah, and they never did anything with it. They just, you know, it was a curiosity, whereas the French actually perfected it and made the method champenoise. So they, you know, the French invented champagne.
Right, but without this strong glass bottle, they would just had a lot of broken glass and a lot of wasted grape juice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Really yeasty wine.
A lot of yeasty spilled wine everywhere with glass. Right?
Broken glass everywhere.
Yeah,
they used to wear metal masks in the cellars of Epinay.
Oh, in the riddling rooms, rooms
to protect them, because they still used to explode like one in 25, whatever, something like that.
Oh my God.
I mean, I used to be a home brewer. That's still a common thing, you know. Definitely going to have one or two bottles explode in your batch.
Jesus Christ,
just happens, man.
That's why I drink whiskey.
Yeah, well,
whiskey doesn't explode on you.
Let's talk about whiskey then.
Yeah.
What influence did the British have on modern day whiskey? Well, I haven't read a single page of the book, sadly.
No one
loaned me a copy.
Well, the Scots sort of, they make the best whiskey in the world. They are the sort of, they make the definitive whiskey.
Japanese are hot on their heels.
The Japanese are. But what the Scots were very good at doing was marketing their product. So the Irish made very good whiskey as well, but the Scots were very good at selling it. So they, you know, they created this very sort of wonderful image of Scots with kilts and claymores and stags and stuff. So basically they were very good at exploiting this kind of romantic ideal of Scotland to push whiskey. And they were also very good at, they invented blended whiskey. So previously you'd have had single malt whiskey, which would have been, you know, tasted very distinctive, and then you'd have had sort of lowland whiskies, which weren't so interesting. And they had the kind of clever idea of mixing them together.
Yeah, let's mix a couple of these things.
So you get a bit of interest, but it's nothing to scare the English with. So they could sell it to people in London.
Yeah, and you put a castle or some antlers on the label, and it's like, done, man.
Yeah.
Definitely buying that.
And then the money just started rolling in as soon as the antlers went on the label.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's all about marketing. I mean,
it's all about marketing.
That's what you do, design and all that jazz. I get it,
dude. Yeah, man.
I mean,
put some antlers on it.
You've told me more than once in the past that the design of a label will often be the deciding factor.
Because you
said it, how it has to look on your back bar, how it has to.
It's not the end product of the whole thing, but it helps.
Yeah,
and it's really, it's just based on like consumers, like you're saying. You know, it's like, if it looks good, like if you can gift it to someone.
Yeah.
You know?
Is it re-giftable?
I don't know if that's legal.
Well, we're right at the halfway mark, so we should take a break, hear from our sponsor, and then we'll come back and talk more about the empire of booze.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys, with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods slogan, Eat 'em to Save 'em, was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
All right, we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. We have Henry Jeffries, author of Empire of Booze, in the studio, and we've just been talking about his book. So what is your what's your favorite part of the book?
I think my favorite part is the chapter on Sicily, because it's probably the least known part of kind of British booze adventures. If you go to Western Sicily, you see all these strange crumbling Georgian buildings dotted around that look like they should be in Bath or Cheltenham or somewhere like that, you know, like an English spa town. But they were in Sicily, and there was this very brief period where Marsala wine was incredibly lucrative, and there were all these British people, not just British people, but Italians as well, harvesting the grapes, making a wine that was quite similar to sherry, and just making a shed load of money. And there was this sort of Anglo-Italian aristocracy in Palermo who built these mansions and put on these huge balls, and you know, it was like sort of
the Marsala barons.
They were like, it was like Dallas, but with but with Marsala. And then it kind of, this was from about 18.
Who shot JR? That's Giancarlo.
And then in about the 20s, it started to decline, and Marsala became a kind of bastardized wine that was only used for cooking. And all the sort of buildings crumbled. And if you go to Marsala now, there's one warehouse, which is owned by the Florio company, which is still thriving. But the two British companies, the Inghams and the Woodhouse, they're just crumbling. There's just the buildings that are derelict. So you get some idea of that it used to be this huge business, and now it's kind of nothing. So it's sort of, it's very melancholy. But also there are a few people still making very good Marsalas, and they are the most wonderful wines because they taste of sort of North Africa. You get these amazing kind of dried fruit, almond type flavors. So if you can search out a good Marsala, they are spectacular.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I mean, like, especially you think that like now would be a good time for that as well, because there's been such a recent sherry boom.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
yeah, fortified wines are crushing. Sherry, vermouth.
Yeah,
right at the forefront. But you don't hear much about Marsala.
No.
Or port wine,
well,
for that matter.
Well, yeah. I mean, more about port, but not necessarily Marsala. But, like, like you said, it's only, like, ever mentioned in cooking. It's
Madeira.
Not,
yeah, all the fortified wines are. But I feel like they are. You're right. There's plenty of room in that category for more uprising, more resurgence.
Yeah, there's one company who make spectacular ones. They're called Di Bartoli. They do everything the old-fashioned way. They hand-harvest the grapes. They do all the grapes come from their own vineyards, and they make it in the sort of time-honored fashion. And their wines are spectacular, but they only make them in very small quantities, and they're quite expensive. It'll be like $50 for a half bottle, but they're worth it.
That's speaking my language now.
Yeah,
and they're great really in cocktails. They're great in cocktails as well. There's a bar in London, 69 Colebrook Row, that makes a Marsala Tony, Martini. That's him. Yeah,
Tony Gliers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tony C.
Yeah, he's pretty good at mixing stuff together.
Yeah,
he's made a name for himself. He's doing all right.
Yeah.
So you're here in New York City. It doesn't sound like you're from here.
No, I'm from London.
Oh yeah. Are you here to tour the book? Are you going to be doing some signings? What's going on?
Yeah, I did a talk actually last night at this sort of gentlemen's club, which I don't mean a strip club. I mean like a before gentlemen's clubs were strip clubs. A club for, you know,
gentlemen. Come on, they're always kind of strip clubs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was no stripping. Yeah. All the clothes stayed on. And I did a talk there. And then I was on Power Lunch on CNBC yesterday, looking very awkward. and then I've got a few meetings, but that's about it, really.
And then back to London? You're not touring around America at all?
No one wanted me. You know, I phoned up all these bookshops in Cleveland, Ohio, and said, do you want me to do a talk? And they just said, never heard of you, so go back to London.
You gotta make your name a little bit first, I guess.
I could do a gig at Porco's maybe when I'm a bit.
Yeah, I think you should. I'll talk to Stefan. He'll be into it. He's game for anything.
Okay.
They'll put some.
It's game.
Game for anything.
For anything.
Yes.
Right. And I mean anything.
They'll put your book to work, and they'll make some tiki drinks out of all this stuff, which is what they did to me. It was great. Made a bunch of bitter tiki drinks.
You know what? Okay.
I'm sorry to jump off topic of your book, but this is, you should hear. Porco Lounge is the number one purchaser of Fernet Branca in the region, not just the state, the region. That extends up to Chicago. Right?
Interesting.
they are not even close to the number one seller. They drink it all.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's not surprising.
Their whole team are Fernet nuts. Like, they run this tiki bar, all this sugar, all this juice everywhere, and all they want is Fernet.
that never surprises me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They drink a lot of it in Argentina, don't they? Isn't it the national drink in Argentina?
Fernet con coca.
Mm-hmm.
Fernet con coca.
It's actually making me want to go back to the topic of rum.
Yeah, let's talk more about rum.
So, I mean, I know about, like, the British Navy had, like, their rations of rum, like, their tot, as it were. When did, I'm having a hard time remembering, when did that get cut off?
I think it was 1970 was when they stopped giving a tot of rum.
Oh, yeah, that's it, 1970 for sure.
Which was called like Black Tot Day.
Right.
And, you know, it was a sad moment in imperial decline. I think it was the moment when Britain finally declined.
They're like, we're not sailing anymore.
We became a second-rate power after that because all the sailors were sober.
Yeah. You know, it took away some of their courage.
Yeah, they didn't have enough fight left in them.
Right. What are we fighting for? ennui on a boat.
I'm depressed.
Right.
I think that that date is amazing to me because like 1970 wasn't really that long ago.
I was alive.
The American Navy was sober in the 19th century, so the American Navy was famously sober. There was no drink on board, whereas the British Navy, you know, they had everything. Masala, they drank a lot. The officers drank masala, and the ordinary crew drank rum.
Right, so that was just so they could, the officers weren't getting as tanked, so they could still have a little bit of control.
They got pretty hammered on.
But they still had a little more control over the...
They had like sugar hangovers.
Over the rest of the crew.
That'd make me like not want to advance in the military. I'm just like, just going to hang around here with all these ding-dongs and drink rum, man.
So all throughout the book, you talk about the spirits themselves and the wines themselves, and then you delve into... For every chapter, there's a cocktail or two. Is that
there's some cocktails, but there's also a guide, a sort of buyer's guide. So you can basically drink your way through the book. So you read a chapter on port, and then it's like, ooh, Taylor's 10-year-old. You know, have a glass of that. In fact, I missed a trick. I should have offered a special edition that comes with a case of liquor.
And then it's not too late.
And then you can actually, I'll do it. Maybe next Christmas.
Yeah, this is
coming Christmas.
This is a Christmas package. Edition.
Yeah,
I'll sell them at a more.
You could charge like $500 for it, but you know, you could put some seriously good booze in, special edition of the book. Maybe I could come around and drink it with you. That could be the sort of, you know, like those whiskey
for things. An extra $50.
Yeah. And for an extra $50, I won't come around.
Yeah. $50, he'll come around. $100, he'll stay away. So what's your favorite drink and how it ties into the chapter that you're talking about in the book? It doesn't be favorite. What's one you'd like to talk about?
Well, I really I'm very keen on fortified wines. Mm. So port, I think, is a fantastic drink. And that was a great trip. I went out to the Douro Valley. Mm-hmm. We went down the river in these old-fashioned barges, the barcos that look a bit like, I know, what are they called? Rabelas. And they look a bit like Viking longboats.
Sure.
And they used to come down. They used to go up the hill. They used to walk cross-country up the Douro Valley for two weeks. Buy the wine and then come down the rapids on these little Viking boats, and they often used to sink and people used to drown. So that it
makes the wine taste better.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that element of danger.
This tastes like a bunch of people died. That makes the wine taste better. Have you not heard this before? No. All right. Maybe it's just me. So is there a cocktail that involves port, or recommend drinking with port?
I have tried a cocktail that which I thought was actually a bit revolting. I think it's called a Princeton or something, and it's gin, like very cold gin, and then you pour port down the side.
Yeah, and it sinks
so
to the bottom.
You get like a double layer effect. It looks really cool.
Looks great.
Absolutely disgusting.
It's like a Puss Cafe with gin on top.
It's chilled gin, right? And then you take like your bar spoon or whatever.
Yeah.
You pour you basically do a sinker of port, and I don't even remember. I think it's like an orange twist. It makes sense.
Is there a reason why one would do this? Sounds like you're ruining two good things.
Yeah.
So you're taking two good things and making one bad one.
Yeah.
Let's get Wondrich on the phone. Wondrich, why do they do this?
So white port is nice in cocktails. White port, yeah, you can, you know, you can use it like sherry or something. But I've never found a cocktail with proper red port that really worked.
Mm. Yeah, the Princeton is like one of the few that I found. Unless you're talking about like a Singery, but even then, if you're gonna do like a port wine Singery, it's like, why not make it a Royale? Because then you kind of cut a lot of the sweetness, because Singery is just like port and sugar.
A crushed ice, twist. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. You don't really see... Yeah, I guess you see a lot more white port than red port.
In cocktails. In cocktails. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
you never see white port just on a list. Like, as a pour, you know?
If you go to Porto, they always get the white port out, and then they secretly admit to you that they prefer sherry. They'll always be like, let's have some white port. And then you go, have you got any Tio Pepe? And they go, yeah, let's have some Tio Pepe.
Dirty secrets. You know, I think it's weird. Nobody likes their own juice except us, right? Everywhere I go, yeah. Well, in the Scotch definitely were drinking some whiskey while I was there. But even some of the people there are kind of like, oh, I'd rather have a bourbon because Scotch is an old man's drink. And then when I was in France, like, nobody drinks cognac.
No one drinks.
They all drink whiskey. They love whiskey. They like
whiskey and a lot of vodka.
Yeah, vodka, Red Bull.
That's what I saw the most.
But huge, yeah, in France.
Yeah.
Big in France.
So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that they'd pull out the port and then be real happy to switch to something else. Nobody wants to drink their own juice except us. Americans love American whiskey.
But if anyone from the Tourism Board of Portugal is out there listening to the show... We would absolutely love to visit Portugal.
Bring us on over and teach us all about it.
Yeah, make us love it.
What? I didn't ask at the top of the show. What was your impetus for writing this? Like you I know when we talk to authors, it's honestly the one of the weird answers we get is that kind of recurs is. I had all this information in my head, and I wanted to get it out.
That's pretty much it. Yeah. And also, I was worried that someone else would write it. I thought it was, you know, it's a good story. It's a good way of writing about the drinks that I like drinking. It basically was an excuse to write a drink book, and I needed a narrative to thread it all together. So why not British Empire?
Yeah.
And you got to do some drinking. And traveling.
Field research, yeah. R&D.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Field R&D is the best R&D.
Yeah.
R&D in your own little bubble is cool, but
I do field research.
Like going out and seeing the thing. That's how
But it would happen. My wife would, you know, would be like, Henry, you're drunk. And I go, I'm not drunk. I'm researching. I'm working. This is work for me.
I'm hip deep in work right now. I'd appreciate some alone time. Now get out of the bathroom and let me finish throwing up.
Awesome. Well, that's about it for the show today.
Man.
Henry, it's been really great having you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
Yeah, really excited to get your book out there, and I'm sure you are as well. The book's called Empire of Booze. It's out through... The publishing company is...
Unbound.
Unbound.
And you can get it through through Amazon, I think.
Hopefully you can, because yeah. That's the...
They're quite well-known, aren't they?
You get everything through... Yeah, it's a little mom-and-pop shop here. Mr. and Mrs. Amazon run it with their son. So it's available on Amazon. What's the price tag?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, well.
$12.99 in English pounds. Don't know what it is in dollars.
That's okay, like 20, 24 bucks, it. 25 bucks maybe.
Get it.
Yeah. The book looks handsome. I can't wait to get a hold of it. It's definitely the type of read that I enjoy.
I'll get someone to send you one. I can't believe no one sent you a book.
He's got a copy.
I'll get the publishers to send you one.
I'd love it. You going to sign it for me?
I don't know how I'd do it. But maybe I'll go into the office and sign it and then send it to you.
I'm just kidding.
It should have like a ring on it from a drink that you put you're thinking about what to sign to Souther.
Yeah, it's some spilt port.
Read more, asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. Invent me some more time and I will read more.
Exactly. Well, cool. So thank you, Henry Jeffries, for being on the show today. It's been a pleasure to have you. So everyone out there listening to this show right now, check out the book Empire of Booze, a history of the British Empire told through drink. That's it for the show this week. Check out Heritage Radio Network for many more programs like this one. Until next week, I'm Damon Bolte.
My name is Souther T.
Thanks, Henry. Cheers.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.